Hahn of Nuremberg. Here, during those centuries, thousands of sinners, and unfortunately, not a few innocent people, spent weeks, months, or even years in gloomy underground cells, the horrors of which were aggravated by dampness, vermin, foul air, and defective sanitation. So bad were the conditions that prisoners released after any considerable term of confinement were found to be broken in health and often mentally enfeebled. Feuchtwanger's Jew Seuss gives a detailed and not overdrawn description of the effect that similar treatment had on a vigorous man in the prime of life. The harsh fashion in which lawgivers punished crime was, however, regarded with apathy by the public, who apparently considered imprisonment, whether wrongly or rightly inflicted, as one of the chances of fortune, or one of the many crosses laid on mankind by heaven, a misfortune that might befall anyone, and which must, therefore, be borne patiently. Guests at the sumptuous banquets and entertainments given in the splendid hall of the Rathaus were not troubled by compassion for the poor wretches lingering, often enough under sentence of death, in the dark cells, only a few yards below. Bad as was the Nuremberg jail, it long compared favorably with most contemporary prisons, either in Germany or elsewhere. Those of the neighboring towns, Bornheim, Frankfurt, Mainz, and Landau, were assuredly no better. But the Nuremberg government appears to have lagged behind in this respect, for a report on the lock, published in 1799, states that in no other prison of the time were conditions so wretched. Everything was out of date, the cells still dark, damp, insanitary, infested with vermin, cleaned at most twice a month, and during the winter insufficiently warmed by braziers of burning charcoal, the fumes of which half suffocated the inmates. Medical attendance and spiritual consolation were almost entirely lacking, even for those who were in urgent need of them. Prisoners, many of them heavily ironed round the waist and at the feet, were confined for years, often together with their innocent children. Visitors and all means of passing away the time were still forbidden, as in the worst medieval times. And yet, centuries before, the Carolina Code had expressly laid down that imprisonment should serve merely to secure the person, and not as a means of torture. The lock consists of a maze of passages, lighted, if at all, by narrow barred windows. In these passages are 60 wooden doors, iron-lined, some of them bearing numbers. On one is the picture of a crowing cock, colored fiery red, from which it is supposed that incendiaries were imprisoned there. On another door is painted a black cat, possibly because the cell was used to confine those under suspicion of magic or of witchcraft. The masonry is of rough stone, and the cells measure, on the average, between 9 and 10 feet in length, about 8 in breadth, and 10 feet or so to the top of the vaulted roof. Originally, the walls were bare, but later they were lined with heavy planks, which, as they did not follow the curve of the roof, considerably diminished the airspace. Along the wall facing the entrance, at the height of approximately 2 feet from the floor, is a wooden shelf or bunk about a yard wide. A bench, also of wood, occupies one side of the apartment. In addition, the cells were formerly provided with a large wooden sanitary bucket fitted with a lid that served as a table. In the passage leading to the torture chamber are three larger apartments, the condemned cells. To these, after receiving sentence of death, prisoners were transferred and watched day and night to prevent suicide or attempts to escape. In one of these cells, besides the usual shelf, bench, and bucket, is a table on which the felon's last meal was laid. Another apartment contains the stocks, an instrument freely employed, not only for the correction of ordinary rogues, but also to extract information from prisoners of